Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Sam Myers, research scientist at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health, founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance, and one of the editors of Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. And you can learn more at Planetary Health Alliance, all one word, planetaryhealthalliance.org. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. We're recording this interview Monday, September 28th. Now to today's guest. I'm not a fan of talking about the environment. I'm not sure how it became the word to describe the natural systems in which we live, of which we are part, and on which we depend. It seems way too abstract for me. I mean, remember, it includes the air we breathe, the land around us, the water we rely on, the food we eat, our planet's climate, the 100 trillion microbes in and on our bodies, and I would say even the ways we choose to live together. When I refer to what are commonly called environmental issues, I say that our goal should be a healthy relationship with the rest of nature and an effective reckoning with climate change. For me, I think this perspective grew out of a number of experiences I had as a young person, including playing in the woods along the banks of the St. John's River in Jacksonville as a young teenager. A college freshman course in which anthropologist Irvin DeVore showed a documentary on the lives of the Kalahari Bush people, which introduced to me an entirely different way to relate to nature and to life, and an organic farm I worked in Connecticut a few years after graduation. Now, I believe today's guest, Sam Myers, shares a similar perspective attained through a different set of experiences, but also, in his case, arrived at through rigorous scientific research and practical public health work around the world. I suspect that to be persuasive and successful, this approach that sees human health as embedded in and integrated with the health of our surroundings is essential, and that any other perspective that allows people to feel separate from the rest of nature may well doom us to failure, and that we will take a lot of the rest of nature down with us as we fall. Sam Myers' new book, Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves, co-edited with Howard Frumkin, explores the impacts of accelerating environmental change on human health. It then offers solutions by reimagining our cities, our food and energy systems, even our economics and ethics, and serves as a hopeful introduction to an emerging field that researchers and universities are now adopting worldwide. I'm excited to learn that this approach is growing in influence, and I'm eager to speak with Sam about his work in developing it. Let me read a few lines from the preface of the book. While this book was written prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the themes it explores have never been more relevant. As it happens, COVID-19 is a prototypical planetary health story. The virus's origin is related to our interactions with nature and wildlife, our food system, and changes in demography and technology. The lessons we're learning about controlling the pandemic underscore the importance of systems thinking, the need for collective action, and the promise of rapid global behavior change. And this global pause also presents an unprecedented opportunity to chart a new course forward. Samuel Myers, MD, MPH, is a pioneer in the emerging field of planetary health, a principal research scientist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance. He also serves as a commissioner on the Lancet Rockefeller Foundation Commission on Planetary Health, the Lancet Commission on Arctic Health, and is a member of the lead expert group of the Global Panel on Agriculture, Food Systems, and Nutrition, and as I said, co-editor with Howard Frumkin of Planetary Health. Welcome, Sam Myers, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. It's wonderful to be here with you.
So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we end up talking about. And so could you briefly share with us your path to the work you do today? And to my mind, and it really, I think, helps people get a feeling for you, go all the way back, childhood, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
All right. Well, I will do my best. So I grew up in New England, based in Boston, with a family that was very connected to getting outdoors. And so I spent a lot of time in the White Mountains in New Hampshire and time out on the end of Cape Cod and salt marshes. And, you know, as a kid, I always felt very connected to nature. It was a place of peace and a place of solace. And I never lost that. I went to college at Harvard and was confused, and it was the beginning of a lifelong of confusion, probably, about exactly how to put all the pieces together. But I was interested in the natural world. I was interested in environmental science, and I was fascinated by human biology and medicine and physiology and sort of how this collection of cells with all its various specializations actually works, and how, as a physician, one might actually interact with all of that complexity to fix something that was broken, which seemed sort of improbable and slightly magical to me. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, should I go into medicine? Should I be a biologist? Should I be a wildlife veterinarian? I actually had a lot of conversations with E.O. Wilson, who was a mentor, and ultimately it was his advice to go ahead and go to medical school and pursue a career as a physician, but really try hard to figure out how to make the synthesis and connect that with the interest in nature and the natural world. And so that's what I did. I went to medical school at Yale, where there's an excellent school of forestry and environmental science, and spent a lot of my time up there. And then I went out to San Francisco to do my internal medicine residency at UCSF. But in the middle of residency, was invited to a dinner with a delegation of Tibetan officials who were looking at the United States park system as part of setting up a new park in Tibet on the north side of Mount Everest called the Chomolungma Nature Preserve. And at this dinner, it turned out I was seated next to the health minister, and she invited me to drop my residency and come to Tibet and spend 2 years developing a brand new integrated conservation and human health project. And I explained that I was terribly qualified for such a job and didn't have any of the right skills or experience, and that she could do a lot better. And she reiterated the invitation, and I warned her that if she asked me three times, I was likely to say yes, so she probably shouldn't, but she did. And yeah. So I had to go to residency the next day and explain to the residency director that I was dropping out of residency, which isn't something people did, and going to live in Tibet for 2 years to manage this project and ask if they would hold me a spot, which ultimately they did. So then I went off to Tibet for 2 years and lived as the only Westerner outside of the major city, lived in a little town halfway between Lhasa and the Sino-Nepalese border, and field managed this project in an area the size of Denmark in the Chomolungma Nature Preserve. And that really started sort of this exploration of sort of in the field, how were these issues of natural resource management and environment connected to issues of health and population and primary health care as well as public health.
I just want to say that seems like such a rare opportunity for someone with your confusion.
It was an extraordinary opportunity. It was also the hardest thing I ever did professionally. It wasn't an easy place to be. There were no other Westerners anywhere outside of Lhasa. This was pre-internet. There was no phone. There was no mail.
Wow.
So I was living in a little mud floored shack with no plumbing, using a communal latrine in a village at 16,000 feet in elevation, getting very deconditioned physically, and driving just enormous distances with a translator I was working with to create a network of village-based health workers in an area the size of Denmark. So wow. It was challenging work, but it was also quite formative. And so at the end of that, I went back, finished residency, and then I did a USAID, American Association for the Advancement of Sciences fellowship, science diplomacy fellowship with USAID. And I worked in the Global Health Bureau in the environmental division, and really working on the same thing, sort of how do we connect the way we manage natural systems with human health, and ended up creating a new mechanism at USAID called ECHO for Environmental Change and Health Outcomes.
So it sounds to me that as unqualified as you felt for the first detour, it, in a way, along with your medical training, made you perfect for this one.
Well, I don't know if I was perfect or dogged, but, I think that I had my head wrapped around an idea that these areas of the state of our planet's natural systems and our health were interconnected. And I didn't understand exactly how or mm-hmm. what the formulation was or what the right way in was, but I was pretty committed to trying to find the synthesis. And so I think...
And the one thing I would say also is that you, unlike many, were not finding it strictly on the academic side of the street, but you were doing that exploration, that discovery, that analysis in the real world.
You know, I think one of the reasons I went to medical school instead of doing a PhD in something like biology or becoming a wildlife biologist was a little bit of skepticism about pure academics mm-hmm. and the kind of abstraction of that, and wanting to be in the real world with real skills, and interacting with real people. And so I think that's right, that there was some desire, if I had all these sort of highfalutin ideas
yeah.
to see whether they actually held any water when you got out to the way real people were living in the world. And so that, really drove this kind of career trajectory that emphasized the sort of practical real world experience first. So it was Tibet for 2 years, then it was USAID for 2 years, where I spent a lot of time in the tropics. Actually, one group that I worked with was the San Bushmen in Botswana. So it was interesting to hear that part of your story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just seeing that documentary that day for a kid, I'm a freshman. I grew up in, a subdivision in Central Florida, had no exposure to the fact that consumption wasn't what made you happy. And,
right.
and it was such an eye-opener. It's funny. I can see the film in my mind at any time as like opening a window into a whole other way of looking at life.
It's a wonderful thing when the right seed lands in fertile soil at the right time. Yeah, yeah. So I did that. And then actually after USAID, I took a job with Conservation International, which, as your listeners probably know, is a great big international environmental conservation NGO. And I ran something called the Healthy Communities Initiative, which again was a project focused on working with different communities all in the tropics, integrating the priority of our organization, which was natural resource management and conservation, with primary health care and health outcomes. And so, really 6 years spent working at this intersection of natural resource management and health at the program level in communities. And, ultimately, and maybe I was slow to come to this because, it seems sort of obvious to me in retrospect, but, what I realized was the people that I was working with in these communities, you know, whether it was the San or in the Solomon Islands or, you know, the Quechi Maya in Brazil, they understood these connections way, way better than I did, all the way down to the roots of their cultures. And the reason that they were dynamiting their coral reefs or cyanide fishing or in other ways destroying their natural resources wasn't that they didn't understand that healthy natural systems were critical to their own well-being. It was because they had 0 degrees of freedom in the decisions that they were making. They needed to feed their kids the next day. And this was how they knew to do that. And that some white guy from Boston coming to talk to them about these connections was not what they needed. Right. And so I got a little frustrated with the idea of trying to address these challenges and address this synthesis at the level of projects, sort of project by project around the world. And I started to feel, you know, the whole world needs to wake up to the moment that we're in right now and understand these connections. And, you know, the way change is going to happen is not one village at a time. It's through really changing the entire framework that we use to think about development of all sorts. And, you know, to create that kind of awakening, we need a whole field focused on understanding the connections between the state of our planet's natural systems, and not just the climate system, but biodiversity and land use and pollution of air, water, and soil, and biogeochemical cycles and resource scarcity like fresh water and arable land. We need to understand how those changes in natural systems are affecting our health and well-being. And there needs to be a whole field focused on those connections. And for such a field to take shape, there needs to be an evidence base. And so we actually need to do primary research to understand these connections. We're sort of espousing them as a matter of faith. And there were tons of documents written, you know, that I would find in the 90s, even early 2000s, that talked about how, you know, the health of people is inextricably linked to the health of our natural systems. But there were never any references. There was very little evidence to support that assertion. So, and if you wanted to change the sort of most hard-boiled people in the world, you needed to build an evidence base.
Yeah, so another thing I hear is that the projects made real for you the perspective that you had found and the need. But I get that without working on the ground in those projects, who knows what you would have understood and what you would have felt needed to be done. But then I see you go, but wait, upstream in information terms, not in natural terms, but in information terms, is what's going on in the universities, in the think tanks and that sort of thing. And that's where you could bring what you had made real. To maybe, if you can bring it upstream, then it can get back down through the systems that actually are making the decisions that put those people in those underdeveloped areas in the situations they're in.
That's exactly right. And I had this sense that it was easy to convince, you know, the Conservation Internationals and the WWFs and the Nature Conservancy type organizations. And it was easy to convince the most sort of environmentally inclined folks that protecting the environment was good for us. But that wasn't the point. That what we needed to actually understand was the evidence to convince, you know, schools of public health all over the world that you can't even think about public health without thinking about our natural life support systems, and convince, you know, the business world that, you know, it's a losing proposition to be doing business on a planet that's crumbling under the weight of our ecological footprint. And so sort of that's what I mean by the sort of more hard-boiled people that don't necessarily have any vested interest in the environment. They're not tree huggers. What they care about is something else. But if you care about global human health, regardless of whether you care about the natural environment. You have to care about the natural environment because it's the underpinning for global health. And so you're right. I felt like no one was going to take that on faith in those circles.
Right.
And so what we needed was, you know, if I believe this to be true, then we ought to be able to show it. And so let's think about how we build that whole evidence base. And so I actually ended up coming back to Harvard and doing my what was called a general medicine research fellowship. It was funded by NIH, and it involves getting your master's of public health and also doing sort of mentored primary research in epidemiology. And so I did a three-year program essentially to sort of retool myself as a research scientist. And for the last 15 years now, have been working with teams of graduate students and postdocs and lots of colleagues around the world to actually do the primary investigation into how our disruption of natural systems affects health. And obviously, our work is just a tiny little sort of pebble on the beach in terms of that overall field. But we've done some of the research that's really helped to sort of establish this evidence base and has then given birth to this very, very new field of planetary health, which really at its heart has this sort of academic discipline and this research base that I'm talking about.
So how, I mean, it sounds like this has all come together very recently. I mean, you refer to the early 2000s, people were still, you know, talking, thinking a certain way. How recent is the emergence of the field? How did it come together? And as I said, I came to sort of a layman's perspective on this decades ago, but that's that perspective that's not going to convince the hard-boiled. That's just something, you know, almost in my gut or my spirit, and you wanted to make it, add to it hard-boiled evidence that would move hard-boiled people. How has this come together, and how do you define planetary health?
Sure. Well, so those are sort of a few different questions, and I should say that, you know, the hero of this story as it's being told is me, because I'm doing the telling, but obviously there are you know, hundreds of other people around the world who are interested in these kinds of questions. And well before planetary health was christened planetary health, there were other researchers around the world that were starting to explore these connections between environmental change and human health. And so I was among that group, and we didn't really have a very compelling name for, you know, really what to call the field. In terms of how it came together, it was really the term planetary health that came into public parlance around July of 2015, so only about 5 years ago.
Wow.
And it was through the publication of a commissioned report in the medical journal, The Lancet, which is really the leading global health journal in the world. And the Rockefeller Foundation supported the creation of a commission on planetary health. So this is sort of the brainchild of the Rockefeller Foundation and Judith Rodin, who was the president at the time, to create a commission to really address this question of how accelerating global environmental change was threatening human health. And so the creation came together in 2014, and we spent a year bringing together evidence and working on this report, and then ultimately published the report in The Lancet in July of 2015. And I think that was really the first time that planetary health kind of emerged as a term for most people in the world. It was also my concern at the time that we were going to release this report that sort of set off these alarm bells about the scale and pace at which we were disrupting and transforming these critical natural systems, and that those transformations were threatening every dimension of human health, and that we couldn't release a report like that and then not provide sort of anything to do about it. And so
yes.
I proposed that we create a new organization called the Planetary Health Alliance at that time. And so it was announced at the same time that we released the commissioned report. And that's the alliance that then started in January of 2016 that I've been directing ever since.
Very good. We're just about at the halfway mark. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Sam Myers. He's a research scientist at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health, founding director, as he just said, of the Planetary Health Alliance, and one of the editors with Howard Frumkin of Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. And you can learn more at planetaryhealthalliance.org. The book, by the way, is with Island Press, and so you can get it from the major booksellers or the independent booksellers online. You can also get it from Island Press, right?
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
And that's okay. So one thing I wanted to return to is that you at one point said this moment in society, and you and your editors start the book by making clear that this is a unique moment in human history, but I suspect that this moment has been made even more unique, and thus that little notation in the preface about the pandemic, since you wrote the book. The pandemic, the resulting economic devastation, which is pretty much global, fires and hurricanes, every season seems to be worse, systemic racism and economic injustice, kind of made worse by and highlighted by fragile democracy under threat at a time when the problems we face more than ever need to, that the ones that I think are existential, climate change, inequality, justice, fragile democracy, technological disruption, cannot be successfully dealt with in the sorts of siloed, fragmented ways that we organize our institutions and our universities. And that this moment is a moment when we can and probably must seize and pivot.
I think that's right. Obviously, there's an enormous amount of complexity there. But I guess what I would start with as a way in is the sort of empirical observation that there really hasn't ever been another moment like this one in human history. And when I talk about this moment, what I'm talking about is the scale of the human enterprise, the scale of our impacts across our planet's natural systems. And, you know, if you look at curves of global human consumption, for example, over time, the consumption patterns actually look relatively modest right up until around 1950 or 1960. But whether you're looking at, you know, global appropriation of freshwater resources or proliferation of cars and trucks or production and use of synthetic fertilizers or paper or plastic production or primary energy use, you know, across the board, what you see are these very similar curves with this sort of modest effect up until about 1950, and then this incredibly rapidly steepening curve that looks almost exponential up until the present. And similarly, if you're looking at metrics of human impacts on, you know, nature, on our natural systems, whether you're looking at biodiversity loss or cutting down the world's tropical and temperate forests or exploitation of global fisheries or addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, again, you see these very, very similar shaped curves. And the reason that all of these curves look the same is because they're all underlain by two really fundamental processes. And one is the growth of the human population. So in 1950, it was around 2.5 billion, and today it's well over 7 billion and growing. And the growth of per capita consumption. So the amount of goods and services that each person on average is consuming every single year. And in fact, the per capita consumption curves are even steeper than the human population growth curves. And so if you imagine multiplying those two together, you get total world GDP, or the total size of the sort of human ask of our planet. And that curve is essentially a vertical line. It runs along horizontal until about 1950, and then it just shoots up in an almost vertical pattern. And so the scale of, you know, the human enterprise of our collective impacts on our natural systems is virtually impossible to overstate. And I think that's what people don't tend to understand. Even if they understand that we're changing the climate, or they understand that, you know, biodiversity loss is a problem, what they don't understand is how extraordinarily recent this phenomenon is and how rapidly changing our impacts on natural systems really are. And so that's sort of the first part of this moment that I think you have to hold on to and understand. And then in that context, I think, yes, I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic has sort of sharpened our focus on how our sort of broken relationship to nature is threatening us. And as you say, it's only the most recent in a whole series of alarm bells that have been ringing, you know, across the planet, whether it was, you know, the hurricane season a couple of years ago with Irma and Maria, or this year's hurricane season, where it seems like every week there's a new hurricane coming into the Gulf, or, you know, the fire season 2 years ago, or the even worse fire season this year on the West Coast, or, you know, and it's not just us, right? It's the fires in the Amazon, and now in the Pantanal, which is supposedly a wetland. The fire season in the Arctic, where there have never been fires before. You know, fires 50 million acres in Australia, in Siberia. And so, you know, and it's not just climate things, right? I mean, it's really across the board that natural systems are sort of crumbling under the weight of the way we live on the planet. And I think that, you know, I think the COVID-19 pandemic has a lot to sort of teach us. Some of it is, you know, just evidence of the danger of a broken relationship to nature. But I think it also has some things to teach us about the way forward as well.
I think I've got a few things to say. One, on the pandemic, I think that the message that may not be the one that everyone takes, as a matter of fact, I would say there are two opposing messages, but I do feel that most lie on one side. One message is this came here from China. Other people brought it to us. That neighbor who isn't wearing a mask is a problem. And so you become more reinforced in your separation from others. That's one. But the other is shared vulnerability, that this is a phenomenon. While climate change and environmental issues do affect everyone, we don't feel it as immediately. But the shared vulnerability that this is affecting people all over the globe, rich, poor, young, old, every race, differently, and that's that. And the way it affects us differently becomes additional lessons in what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. But I think that shared vulnerability is part of what makes the moment pregnant with possibility for me.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And if you sort of think back and you sort of imagine, you know, what would it be like if the world's sort of scientific and research community were sending out decades of warnings that if we continued on, you know, the current path, that there was a very, very high risk of a really, you know, cataclysmic event in, you know, the form of spillover from wildlife populations and a new pandemic. And what would it be like if, you know, they proposed that what we needed to address this huge sort of, as you call it, existential threat was concerted global collective behavior change, and you know, that's what it would take to really take this threat seriously. And then imagine if there were, you know, national leaders who, instead of listening to that guidance, instead sort of went on a war against science and research, right? I mean, it sounds awfully parallel to the climate crisis and the overall planetary health crisis that we're in. And one is very, very visible and is very tangibly affecting our lives. And the other is also very tangibly affecting all our lives, but it's much more complex and harder for us to see, you know, day to day. And so I think there are actually lessons for us in how we've responded to the COVID pandemic around how we could be responding to planetary health. I mean, we've just seen for the first time in human history, massive, extremely rapid global collective behavior change. And, you know, we wouldn't have believed it was possible, right?
That's right.
But suddenly almost everybody in the world has started to do a whole lot of what they do very, very differently.
And, yeah. Sam, I interviewed Robert Frank, the economist from Cornell recently. Uh-huh. His new book is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And he points out that social contagion, that is the fact that you're affected by, you know, what other people around you are feeling and thinking, has mostly been viewed as a negative. Teenagers smoke because other teenagers smoke. People get fat because their friends get fat. Those sorts of things. But that he points out exactly what you just did, that the scale of change in human behavior, human social behavior, in the last 6 months is unprecedented.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think there's some other things that we've also seen. We've seen a lot of altruism,
yes,
which is really, really exciting to see. And I think really affirming in terms of where we need to go in terms of taking care of the people who are most vulnerable. We've seen that nature recovers.
We've seen,
you know, many, many instances where air has gotten cleaner, where water has gotten cleaner, where wildlife are moving back into, you know, their original habitats because there's less human activity. And so we're seeing the capacity of nature to regenerate on really, really short timescales. We've seen that science matters, right?
Right.
We've seen,
right?
Like, it turns out that the governments that took the science really seriously and follow the recommendations of public health scientists have protected their populations much, much more effectively than governments that have called that science into question. And, you know, lives have been lost as a result of that.
Yeah. As someone who actually studied public health and is at a school of public health, I would think that public health has never been as recognized or as listened to in my lifetime as it has in these recent months. Let me ask you one other question. I'm going to jump away, but it's from this for a second. You talked about that there are two factors to the huge scale of human behavior's effects on natural systems, population and consumption. Now, even on that, you and I were involved in a webinar in the last week or so, and there were questions submitted by folks who, you know, RSVP'd. And a lot of them had to do with population. It seems to me that for too many people, population is what they look at rather than the combination of population times consumption.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And in the book that you mentioned that we've just published, we have a chapter on population and consumption. And the authors make a great metaphor in saying that, you know, arguing whether the driver of global change is population or consumption is like arguing whether the area of a rectangle is determined by the length or the width. You know, it's one multiplied by the other. And I think it's, you know, population is obviously a fraught question, particularly in the environmental community. We have a really checkered history in
yep.
the past of thinking about these questions. And I think it's really unfortunate because, in fact, it seems pretty clear that what we need in order to address global population growth are things that are really, really important to do in their own right that have absolutely nothing to do with coercion. And so they're, you know, educating girls, providing economic opportunities for women, providing access to family planning for couples who want it. And all three of those things are incredibly valuable in their own sake for gender equality. You know, access to family planning reduces maternal and infant mortality, improves child spacing, which improves child health. You know, so these are things that are important to do anyway, and that's actually a really, really important theme in planetary health, which is this idea of co-benefits. We haven't talked a lot about solutions, but you know, when you talk about in your byline a world that just might work, there are a whole lot of things. In fact, the whole second half of our book mm-hmm. goes through all the domains of sort of human activity, whether it's food systems or our energy system or cities and the built environment or the chemical industry or manufacturing and economics, and talks about just this extraordinarily rich terrain of solutions of how we could get to a world that just might work. And it turns out that there's a ton that we can do to get where we need to go. And a lot of the things that we want to do actually have these co-benefits. They actually improve health and well-being, whether it's, you know, renewable energies that make huge contributions to air quality. And we're losing somewhere around, you know, 8 million lives annually from air pollution today. And so the conversion over to cleaner forms of energy would not only address climate change, but it would also have these huge health benefits. And I mentioned, you know, family planning and in food systems, you know, converting our diet to more vegetable sourced protein and eating less red meat would really reduce the ecological footprint of our food system, but it also would pay huge dividends in terms of our own health. And so, you know, as you go through these different kinds of solutions over and over, the story that you see unfold is that these are things, this is not a story of deprivation and making do with a less good way of life. This is a story of embracing things that will actually improve, you know, our quality of life and our health while also reducing our ecological footprint.
Yeah, one of the things that I hear in that is that entrenched ways of doing things often have financial incentives attached. That is, one thing I notice is old industries, let's say the dirty, the fossil fuel industry, they have accumulated a certain amount of power and wealth, and they can use that to forestall what would otherwise be a sort of natural, almost, transition to newer forms of cleaner energy. And I think that happens in every field and way of life, that there, and so that the ability to even see the co-benefits is a little challenged by the way that the entrenched industries can have their hand on the scale. But I want to talk about two different things that came up for me in what you were saying. One is, I don't want to miss the talk about economics and GDP, because you tell a wonderful stroller story about the co-benefits of not buying a new one every time.
Yeah, well, you know, as I mentioned, we have a couple of chapters in this book. One is all about business and the opportunities for sort of embracing circular economy and other kinds of innovations in business, and how important the private sector is going to be in terms of getting us towards this world that just might work. The second chapter is about economics and economic theory, and really then dovetails into policy and how we address these policy issues. And, you know, a big part of that chapter in economics is a critique of GDP, and that we've become slightly slaves to, you know, sort of measuring GDP. And of course, you manage what you measure. And so we're trying to optimize GDP when in fact GDP as a metric does a pretty bad job of capturing what actually makes us happy as a society. It does nothing to really address questions of happiness, of the state of our environment, of social connectedness, of equity. And so the authors of the chapter, just as an example in talking about GDP, talk about, you know, if you have a baby and you go out and you buy a really crummy baby stroller, and you use it for a year and it's already starting to fall apart, and you take it off to throw it in the landfill, and then, you know, the next couple buys their baby stroller. That's a terrific success from the standpoint of GDP. Whereas if you buy a beautifully made baby stroller, or better yet, you know, you inherit one from, you know, your parents who kept theirs in the basement after they used it for you, right? And so now you're using this old wonderful baby stroller, and you know, your kids grow out of it, and then you pass it to your brother, and then he passes it to the neighbor down the street, and she passes it to somebody around the corner. You have this sort of whole history of shared use of this baby stroller, and it actually creates a kind of social connectedness between these families. And of course, it prevents having to, you know, mine all the materials that were used for making a bunch of baby strollers, and prevents sending them all off into a landfill. And yet, that's actually a complete failure from the standpoint of GDP. In fact, the one that you inherited, it doesn't even show up.
That's right.
On the GDP. And so it's just a point to say, you know, the things that we really value in society need to be the things that we're actually tracking and measuring to see whether we're making progress toward our goals. And GDP does a pretty crummy job of actually capturing that.
Right. Bill McKibben, in a book, God, many years ago now, Deep Economy, people mostly think of him as you know, now about climate change and so on. But Deep Economy, what he looked at was the fact that as we had become richer and richer from the 50s to the present, there's a survey every year about how happy Americans are. And our happiness had gone down as our material wealth went up. And his conclusion was that the cost in community of the way of life that built the economy so greatly was, you know, we were paying more in our loss of community than we were getting from, you know, economic wealth. And I think that's so clear. Which brings me to this notion of, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, the role of mindsets, worldviews, narratives, right? And let me read you a quote which really... This was right. I happened to read this for the first time after the 2016 election, when I needed to read quotes that would help. If you want to, this is Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, most famous for writing The Little Prince. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And what strikes me about that is, we need messages, stories, narratives that can inspire us. And it seems to me that there's a message that arises from this perspective of planetary health integrated with human health that might reach or move people in a way that other environmental messages have not. You're thinking about this area.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I would say two things. The first is that... the environmental community has tended to use pretty apocalyptic, catastrophic language. And, you know, whether it's Jim Hansen saying game over for the planet, or, you know, all the other sort of similar proclamations. And I think it's a disservice to forward action. And our whole last chapter of this book is really trying to paint a kind of aspirational vision for the bright future that we could have if we actually get this stuff right. And it's not hard, right, to imagine a future in, you know, 100 years for our grandchildren in which human population is actually stabilized and is falling as a sort of natural progression of the demographic transition, and where we've transitioned to a zero carbon energy economy, and where we're actually producing food and, you know, manufactured goods with just dramatically more efficiency, and we're living in cities where we're optimizing mental and physical health but minimizing our ecological footprint, and where as a result of all of those kinds of innovations in how we live, there's actually more room, you know, with every passing decade for the rest of the biosphere. And to me, that sort of bright, aspirational future is every bit as realistic as the sort of apocalyptic visions that we hear about all the time. And it all comes down to the choices that we make. So one thing I would say is that yearning for the sea, that we need to hold that image of where we're trying to get to,
yes,
that aspirational future in our heads as, you know, we try to, you know, find the courage and the strength every morning to put our shoulders to this particular wheel. The other thing that I would say is that narrative is so important, and that, you know, underneath the global ecological crisis that we are currently facing is this public health crisis. So the ecological crisis is driving now a global health crisis, and that's what we write about in this book. But that underneath both of those crises, I think we're facing a spiritual mm-hmm. crisis. I think that we've become disconnected from nature, and that we need new stories to tell ourselves about our place in the world, about our relationship to nature. We need to reinvigorate the reverence and the awe that many of us feel toward the natural world with the authority to guide our decisions and our actions as a society. It needs to be fundamentally wrong and immoral for us to treat our oceans and our atmosphere as gigantic garbage dumps, or having a new shared narrative about what's acceptable and where we're trying to go and what it means to lead a good life.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing, this is kind of a contrarian sort of question, but it occurred to me as I was reading and preparing for this. Despite the inadequacy of our responses so far, there is a lot of attention paid to climate change. Are we missing something about the relationship of ourselves to nature by focusing on climate?
I think we're not missing, I mean, we may be missing something about our relationship to nature, but even additionally, we're missing the scale of the challenge that we're facing. So climate change is too narrow a framing, and it suggests focusing on too narrow a sort of root cause. So when we talk about climate change, we're isolating one of the natural systems that we're busy transforming. And then when we think about solutions, we go to energy systems and we talk about that. But in fact, we're transforming all of our natural systems. We're driving the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth, and we're polluting air, water, and soil to the point where it's leading to 9 million deaths a year. And so it implies that the root cause is energy decisions, when in fact the root cause is just the scale of our global ecological footprint. And so instead of focusing on the fact that we need to decarbonize our energy economy, which we absolutely do, but that's not enough. We need to rethink the way we do just about everything. So it's not climate change, it's everything change. And the response is, you know, that we need to rethink how we produce food, manufactured goods, energy, how we live in cities. You know, the good news is we actually know how to do all of those things. And so the solutions are there. But I think it does take this broader framing of understanding that the real root cause is that we are outstripping our planet's capacity to absorb our wastes or provide the resources that we're using sustainably. And so we really need to find a new way of living on Earth.
Mm, absolutely. Let me see. I want to ask these questions, and then if I have time, I'll ask one more. What can listeners do? What could they take from this conversation and do to become part of the planetary health solution?
Well, so when I get that question, I tend to think in these sort of three domains of action. So I think the first thing people can do is kind of just a personal audit. And you can think about how you live. You can think about what you eat. And, you know, there's been a lot written about the ecological footprint associated with different kinds of diets, and simply moving away from a lot of red meat in the diet is really good in terms of reducing your ecological impacts, but also, as I said earlier, has big health benefits. We can think about how we get around. And so trying to reduce reliance on automobiles and move toward, you know, muscle-powered locomotion, whether it's walking or biking to work. We can think about how our energy is produced in our communities and pushing hard for clean energy options, and how our neighborhoods are designed to try to create more green spaces that bring us together with social connectivity and improve mental health and are also good for air quality and reducing the heat island effect. And so there are lots of things sort of on an individual level, how our houses are put together, whether, you know, you can do an energy audit, you can try to be more efficient. So there are lots of sort of personal decisions, even, you know, how many children you have that have big impacts on your environmental footprint. The second thing that I think you can do is think about your sort of professional energy. And in many instances, there are opportunities to have your work connect to the challenges of planetary health. I think this is particularly true when I'm talking to students who are just setting out on careers. And, you know, there's really no skill set that is not relevant to planetary health, whether it's the arts and humanities and this sort of creation of this new narrative that we were talking about, or, you know, law and governance and civil society, or the sciences, or engineering and technology. But across the board, all of those skills are relevant to kind of constructing this this new trajectory that we're talking about. And then the third domain, which I think is hard to overemphasize, is that there's only so much that you really can do as an individual, and that ultimately you need to go out and find your partners. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the sort of power problems that you were talking about earlier, of these exploitative industries that have a big vested interest in the status quo, they're not going to, you know, come around because they see the evidence. They're going to come around because they get forced to. And the way they're going to get forced to is through collective action. So it's going to take, you know, an organized, you know, large-scale social movement saying, you know, these kinds of practices are no longer acceptable, and holding governments accountable to changing what our policies look like, and holding industries accountable to changing, you know, their practices. And that takes social power, and that takes organizing. And so, you know, whether it's an interest in food systems and reducing food waste, or energy systems and addressing climate change, or, you know, biodiversity loss, find your partners and come together. And the last thing I'd say is, you know, come to the Planetary Health Alliance and, you know, sign up for our newsletter. And we're creating a whole sort of online community. So we welcome people to join us, and we can often help connect people to things that are associated with their particular interests.
And though this grew out of think tanks, nonprofits, universities, and so on, the Planetary Health Alliance is there for everyone, right?
It absolutely is. And in fact, we're really interested in kind of expanding our reach to include more of the private sector. We have some government agencies that are part of the alliance, and we're actively engaged with different parts of industry that are kind of leading in moving towards what we call the great transition, or a new way of living.
Excellent, excellent. We're going to bring it to a close. So again, the book is Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. And I'm going to say something about the book. I have an approach that I often look at when I'm thinking about these interviews. I call it, it's broke, let's fix it. The first question is, what's the evidence that a system is broken? The second one is, what's the history? How did it happen? And the third is, how do we fix it? And I think that Planetary Health, with its many chapters by its many experts, tries to do exactly that. How did our interactions become unhealthy? What's the evidence that that's so? But also the solutions in every field, from food to urban policy, as to how we can change. You can learn more at Planetary Health Alliance, all one word, planetaryhealthalliance.org, for this conversation and many other interviews and articles. And to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles that I choose each week to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most other podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to GN Production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Sam Myers. Keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for having me.